Well, good afternoon. Just took a wonderful walk through this neighborhood. Such a great place to walk. Every garden is a little bit different and has big touch of people's care. Everybody is really, even though it's very simple, it's obviously cared for. And it's lovely to see a little special stone here and a little blush of flowers over here that somebody thought of. Somebody actually paid attention to what was happening and did something to uplift it, not only for themselves, but for the whole neighborhood. It always kind of inspires me. A little effort doesn't take much, just a little bit, and everything starts to shine. So I had a couple of things that I wanted to share. One is the names of Buddha that we just chanted this afternoon or this morning. Because I think we don't know who those are. It's just a lot of sounds that we make. And I thought it would be well to know, because they're all intimately involved with us and our practice. This is the morning echo, so in the evening we chant, after we've chanted the Prajnaparamita Sutra, then the Kokyo chants by herself, himself. Now I've forgotten what the evening one is. Julian, remind me. Before the All Buddhas and Ten Directions.
Oh, the one that we do on Tuesday?
Yeah.
May the merit of this sutra
extend to all things and all places, so that we together with all beings might be the Buddha way. So that's to take whatever merit we gathered up by chanting the sutra. And I'm not sure what merit is. Some goodness, I guess. If we achieve some goodness, then we offer it to all Buddhas in the Ten Directions, past, present, and future. In other words, to the welfare of all things, rather than keeping it close and being all special. We give it away. So in the morning echo, it's a little more complicated. It's looking upward. We deeply wish for Buddha's true compassion. Bowing down, we ask for the illumination of Buddha's understanding. Now that we've chanted the Prajnaparamita Sutra and the Metta Sutra, we offer its merit, again, to all of our teachers. So Shakyamuni Buddha is first, and then Mahaprajapati, the first female ancestor, who was Shakyamuni Buddha's stepmother. His mother died when he was born, and so his mother's sister, who was also the king's wife, the king had a number of wives, adopted Buddha and raised him. So Maha Prajapati means great Prajapati. Maha just means great. So great Prajapati became great, not because she raised Buddha, but because she finally persuaded him to allow women to be ordained also. It took a long time. Buddha resisted it very hard. He didn't think it was a good idea. And finally, on the third time, instead of asking him again, she shaved her head, and all of her followers did too. And they appeared at Buddha's door and told Ananda that they were there to announce that they were going to do it anyway. And Ananda went out in and talked to Buddha about it. And Buddha said, no, it's not a good idea. It really isn't. And Ananda said, didn't you say that all beings are Buddha nature? And Buddha said, well, yeah. And Ananda said, well, these women, aren't they the same as untouchables and all these criminals and all these other people that you've ordained? And Buddha had to agree that yes, that of course. So then he, so it was very difficult, and she persisted very strongly, and became a very, very fine and famous teacher in her own right. She is often depicted in teaching positions as if she were always sort of giving out the Dharma. And there's a wonderful statue of her at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City. Someone did it for them, and it's beautiful. And again, she's sitting and teaching. So that's Maha Prajapati. The next one is... Which one?
Bodhidharma.
Oh, Bodhidharma, of course, who took the Dharma from India to China and gave us our practice, sitting practice, sitting only practice. He sat in a cave for 9 years. And then Ehe Dogen comes after that. He took the Chinese practice into Japan and is our direct ancestor, you could say. And then directly after Ehe Dogen comes Tengai Bunryu. Tengai Bunryu. Everybody in Koban's family is a Bun. Koban says it's Manjushri's family name. I don't know. That seems outlandish to me, but that's what he said. It goes all the way back. It's probably a very ancient name. So Tengai Bunryu is Koban's father's name, his Buddhist name. And Koban's father was the abbot of the family temple in Kamo, outside of Niigata. And it's a very, very old temple, 400 or 500 years old. It's on the river, very beautiful, big gardens back behind. The doors are open at 7 o'clock in the morning, and people are coming and going all day long. It's a constant thing. And his father was alive. There was a training monastery next to the temple, and many, many monks were trained there and were training when Koban was born. But his father died when he was 8 or 9 years old, and then the war happened also, so everything stopped, and now it's a family temple that serves the community. They have festivals, wonderful festivals. They take care of the dying and the troubled, and whoever needs help, it's always available. I hope everybody has a chance to meet them and visit them. It's perfectly possible. Koban's brother was the Hojo-sama all the time that I knew Koban. And he died just a couple of years ago, and his son now, Bune, another Bu, is the abbot. And he emailed me and asked to be my friend on Facebook. So, it's in characters. I didn't know what it was at first, because it's just Japanese characters. And I thought, what is this? And then it showed a picture of the family temple, and then he said hi in English. And so then he didn't have any other friends. So I put all my student and friends into inviting them to be friends to Bune. So now we've got this network of Facebook connections to Jokoji, which is the name of the temple. So that's Tengai Bunryu. And then Hozan Koe isn't a boon, you notice. It's Koban's old master, who adopted Koban when he was about 12. Koban was ordained when he was 11 or 12 by a cousin. He had cousins who were very high up in the Soto school, and he said it was very difficult You can read about it on the Koban Sama website. Koban's autobiography tells about how it was when he was a kid and they shaved his head and all the kids teased him at school. It wasn't easy, actually, to be a kid out of that temple. So he was sort of... Hozan Koe was a big, gruff guy who taught English in high school and was a priest of another temple, a very, very beautiful, much smaller little temple, sort of tucked back in the trees with mossy rocks all around, very sort of like being in the redwoods. It's very lovely to be there. And he was very different from Koban. He smoked cigars. He didn't sit zazen. He did chanting meditation every morning. He just chanted for a couple of hours early, early in the morning. And he was childless, he and his wife, and very disappointed because there was no one to inherit the temple. So that was going to be Koban's job. He adopted Koban. Koban took his name, Chino, and became the heir to... I can't remember the name of the temple. Maybe I will. So that's who Hozan Koe is. A very wonderful guy. When I visited with my kids were all teenagers, big lanky boys, and a great big tall husband who they all banged their heads on everything in Japan because everything was lower. And he invited us over for dinner, and they served a beautiful, beautiful dinner. And then to entertain us, because he didn't speak English really, he taught English in school, but he couldn't speak it, he put on Beethoven. He said, "I will play you my favorite music." So I think it was the Fifth Symphony. I'm pretty sure it was the Fifth Symphony. And so we just sat in this cloud of music in this beautiful temple with his old master. And by that time, Koban had... gone through a lot of drama around inheriting that temple because he got invited to go to America and his old master said, "No, you can't. You've got to stay here and you've got your work to do." And Koban asked three times and his master said no three times and he went anyway. So he was in really, really bad trouble, not only with his master but with his family and the whole town. It was really difficult. And yet Koban felt called to come. Suzuki Roshi asked him, please, to come and help create a monastery for Americans here. And it was Koban's biggest dream. So he came. And then there was a big flood, and his family temple was flooded, so Koban went back. And his old master thought, oh, he's back. No problem anymore. And then Koban came back to America again. So by the time I knew him, knew his old master, one of Koban's students had gone to stay in the little town, and he would sneak over and chant with the old master without saying who he was. He would just slip in and just join him in the chanting. And then go away again. And finally, the old master couldn't stand it anymore, and he asked him who he was. And he said, "I'm one of Koban's students." And everything began to break open then. And more students came to visit, and he saw that Koban's work was real, that he wasn't just out here playing around being a cowboy or something, or a hippie, that he was actually training people. So it was very touching. It was very difficult for everyone. But we all became friends in the end. It had a happy ending, which was really a mercy. So Ho-un Ko-bun is your grandfather, you could say. It's my teacher. So it's my teacher's teacher. Your teacher's teacher is Koban. And then the bodhisattvas come after that. Manjushri, Avalokiteshvara, and then everybody else who we didn't manage to mention also. And we dedicate the merit of that to them and to lasting peace in the Sangha, tranquility of daily practice, dissolution of all misfortune, and fulfillment of all relations. So it seems like it covers everything. So we should chant often, you know. Just keep everything polished up and beautiful. So that's that. Are there questions about that?
I have a couple. I think this is not like a complete list of.
Oh, no.
Okay. Because there's a lot of space between like Dogen and Tendai, I imagine.
I should bring that list because actually ordained people are supposed to chant that list every single morning, the list of the ancestors, and it's 100 or 97 or something like that in Koban's lineage. And each teacher has a different lineage. Koban's lineage is different from Suzuki Roshi from Dogen on, I think, or from somewhere in there it branches off. But it's just a list of names of many, many teachers. And each one of those names, 100 names, stands for hundreds. It's all metaphor for how it came to us. It came through hundreds and hundreds of very sincere, hard-practicing people. One thing that's been done in the last 10 or 15 years is to add women's names into it. Because up to then, we all believed that it was all men. Because that's all that's on that list, is guys. And then people started doing research. And if you've seen Grace Shireson's new book about women practice, has anybody seen that? Oh, I should bring it in. Oh, it's a wonderful book. And they've done a lot of research and found lots of women, great women teachers all the way back through ancient China. Women, Korean women were the first ones to bring the Dharma to Japan. There's just lots of information. So there's a list of women ancestors that goes with that long 100 list of men. I'll bring that in. I'll try to remember that on Tuesday.
Okay. My other question was about like fulfillment of all relations. Like, what is? Can you expand on that? Like, what is?
Oh, I think that's the essence of the practice, really. To keep things clear between ourself and everybody else. Including, you know, the earth and the sky and the sea and the the animals, all things that we relate to everything. We're in relation to, just by sitting on a chair, we're in relation to a chair. Much less as we're sitting face to face with each other, we're in relation with each other. And if it's not clear, it's unfulfilled. And in our practice, fulfillment is the essence of it in a way. That between oneself and one's teacher is what transmission is, the fulfillment of the relationship. It's Suzuki Roshi talks about that quite a lot. It requires sincere practice, long sincere practice with somebody in order to fulfill the promise of the Dharma. It isn't self-fulfillment so much as fulfillment of the space between, which includes everything. So, it happens with many, many things. It's, you know, we call it love in the simple way of, it starts out as love, or it starts out as connection. And if we're brave enough, then we open ourselves to it. And we open it to ourselves to it with our cat and our dog, or, you know, the ocean when we go to visit, or, you know, all things. But to have a relationship with another human being cultivates it even more deeply. So it includes all of those things. And fulfilling relations. Need it?
Talk a little bit about merit. I know it's hard to grasp, and I'm wondering if it's something like, or if it relates at all to grace, or the idea of grace, where you can't really do anything for it. It just happens.
Yes. Yes, there are several versions of understanding merit, and one is that you earn it just like you earn money. You know, if you're really good, then you earn merit, and then you're a better person. But our understanding of it is just as you say. It can't be earned. It comes as grace. We could call it grace. And we don't keep it. The other thing I wanted to talk about, just to tell you a little story that I read not long ago about Suzuki Roshi that I thought was so interesting. He told about being in charge of a temple, a priest of a little temple in Japan during the war, when everything was really, really difficult, almost nothing to eat. And he said most of the priests that he knew, he called it, put on suits and shiny shoes and went to work in town in order to get by and survive, basically. And he decided that he had given his life to the Dharma and that he thought that the Dharma would take care of him. And so he didn't do that. He stayed with the temple, and he decided that he would plant a garden in the front yard of the temple. So he hoed it all up, and he planted yams. And he said it did pretty well, and one of the neighbor ladies was helping him, and she asked him about his supplies, and he said, well, I've got these yams. They're not quite ready. And she said, well, what about rice? And he said, I don't have any. And she couldn't believe it. She said, you have no rice? He showed her the bin, this big bin, and there was not one grain of rice in there. So she gave him some of her rice and told everybody. And so they all started giving him rice. And he said he ended up with a lot of rice, and he felt very badly about that because everybody else was... So he started giving his rice away until he didn't have any anymore. And he said they all survived in the war this way, that they all took care of each other. And he said he always felt that the Dharma, that he had been right, that the Dharma had sustained him because he had faith in it and didn't try to do everything himself, didn't try to figure it all out and try to push things through. He allowed things to open up as they would, which also included relationship, that he didn't do it all by himself. He did it in concert with everyone. And I thought, for us, what a wonderful kind of model. Not that we're sustaining a temple or our lives even, but that we can depend on the Dharma much more than I think, than I do. But it really struck me how hard it is to allow that so simple thing, and how important it is. That's what our practice is all about. That we can depend on it. So that's my little story. So maybe that's enough. Thank you.